didn't say we're recording.
Not nice.
I want you to accept it.
That's why I didn't tell you.
Yeah, I know. Okay, so I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what a nevi'a is. And so the first thing is to do a simple translation, which is a prophetess. We are talking about women prophets in the Tanakh, in our Jewish history. And we're focusing on that to show and highlight how women are empowered and the strength of women that exists within Judaica. I see a lot of faces that know so much more than I do, so I'm going to smile every so often when I am humbled and embarrassed. So anyway, but I'll move on. So what we're seeing in the Tanakh are these very strong women. What we also see is that throughout Jewish history, that Hashem actually gave nevuah or prophet-tearing to many people, to Jews and non-Jews, to women and men. And this wasn't specifically an exclusive as what we usually think of, or what I usually thought of, as really a male-dominated thing. Women were and have and are prophets in our Jewish history. And in order to be a prophet, I think it says a lot about what that woman was. So I'm going to give you kind of a high level understanding of what it is. One of the things that struck me is this phrase, and I've heard it many, many times. Aryeh Kaplan does an amazing job in explaining what it means, which is a prophet must be intelligent, wealthy, and strong. And for many years I've heard this, and I thought, wealthy, strong, like, why? Who cares about my physical strength in terms of being a prophet? Why should that determine how I can be or how not? And that's not what we're talking about. Aryeh Kaplan shows that we're not talking about physical strength. We're not talking about material wealth. We're talking about spirituality. We're talking about a spiritually intelligent person, one who knows Derech Eretz, one who knows the ways of Hashem and is attuned to that way of Hashem. We're talking about wealth in the education and the needs of Hashem and what Hashem is asking of us, and strength and able to take all those needs and all those requirements and all those ways and be able to actually effectuate it, actually be able to put it tachlas to bit at the end of the day into our lives and live the way that Hashem has asked. That's the strength that we're talking about. Those are the attributes, the way the attributes are really supposed to be manifested. And that is why Hashem has picked not only these four prophetesses, but the others that you see. There is a lot of preparation by the women themselves to become on this high level. It shows how women are leaders, for sure. How women can develop the spiritual needs that are necessary in order to be, as you know, to be close to Hashem. I don't want this class to be we're just as good as men, because I don't. That's a different topic for a different day. What I want to say is how strong we are in and of our own right, and that's a strength that's even stronger than any differentiation or any comparison with any other group of people. So with that, I want to start with Devorah, and who is also speaking about Devorah? Isn't that cute? Let's go ahead.
Okay, so Devorah was a judge in Israel, and she was the fourth judge after the time of Joshua, and Joshua came right after Moses. And the judges were people who helped to unify the Jewish people after the time of Joshua. It was their job to arbitrate Jewish law and to lead people in spiritual matters and to dispense advice and wisdom. Sometimes they were military leaders, and sometimes they were spiritual leaders. And so Devorah was in this category of these kinds of people who led the Jewish people at this time. And basically the reason they were chosen really was because their real power lay in their Torah knowledge and their ability to kind of, like, you know, dispense Jewish law. So while the job was typically held by Jewish men, there were a few women who did it, and Devorah was one of these women. And the reason that she was chosen was because in her time she was the brightest star of her generation. She was just like she was the perfect person for the job. She was the only person for the job, you know? So that's why she was chosen to do this. Now imagine, you have this woman who's described in the Torah as a fiery woman, a fiery personality. So, like, who would you match such a woman up with? Who would you set this woman up with on a date? You know, like, how do you match such a lady? So it's said that her husband was an unlearned man. And while it said that, one midrash says that he was the general of the Jewish army, we'll find out later that may or may not have been such a great job, but she was still a fiery personality, and she was a very strong woman. So how was it that, you know, in this day and age, you know, in the age of Oprah, right? So if you had such a person on TV, the husband would have been like, it's too much, I can't deal with this person, you know, we're just going to have to call it a day, you know? So how does Zipporah make such a relationship work? So the Torah tells us that she would make the wicks for the menorah in the temple, and she would give them to her husband. So her husband would bring them to the temple and help to light the candles. So she didn't like force him to do this. She did this in like a nice, like gentle kind of way. You know, like you don't tell your husband like, oh, you know, like maybe you should like have one less cookie. You know, like it's like one of, you don't tell him he's fat. You say like, you know, maybe like, you know, you give nice gentle ways of like trying to help your husband and guide your husband. So this is what she did. She did this not for any personal gain. She just did this for the happiness of seeing her husband grow as a person. She wanted her husband to be also like a person in his own right, a strong personality, a special person, you know, and, you know, being a fiery personality, a strong woman, she knew she had to go about it in a certain way so that she wouldn't kind of overbear on him and kind of overshadow him. So let me tell you about what was going on in Israel at the time Deborah was the judge. The Israelites were being ruled by the Canaanites, and the Canaanites were technologically advanced people who were very mean. They were very mean people. And so they basically just bowled over the Jews because they just had so much more going for them. They had the technology, they had like tons of manpower, the Jews weren't even allowed to go out on the roads for fear they were going to be attacked. Like, it was just a very dangerous time to be Jewish in Israel. And so what happens is Deborah receives prophecy that Hashem tells her, okay, let's go, you're gonna beat these people. And she's like, okay, we're gonna do it. So she goes to her husband Barak, who's the general of the Jewish army, and she says, all right, we're gonna go and we're gonna defeat the Canaanites. And he's like, I don't know, honey. I don't think so. And she's like, no, we are. We're going to do it. Let's go. So he's like, all right, I'll go if you go. Like, I'll go if you come with me. And she's like, all right, so let's go. We have to do it. So because Barak stepped back in this way, so Deborah receives the full merit of being the victor of the Jewish people. You know, she was the one who said, let's go. We have to do this. So what happened is he got together an army of about 10,000 men. Barak got together an army of 10,000 men, and these were not the cream of the crop. These were like not the people you would have chosen to be soldiers in an army, you know? And you have to imagine, he's going up against the most advanced army at the time. Like, they have 900 iron chariots, whatever that means, you know? They have thousands of men to go behind it. These are like, is a well-oiled machine of soldiers. And you have like the Jews who are like, we're gonna fight you. So basically what happens is Barak leads his army to the top of a mountain, Mount Tabor, and Sisera follows him. And Sisera, because of his ego, Sisera was the general of the Canaanite army, because of his ego, up until this point, he'd been undefeatable. There was no way these like silly little Jews were gonna defeat him, you know? So he lets himself be led basically into a trap. He's in a valley up against a river with all his men. So it starts to rain, and the Jews charge down the mountain, and panic just ensues. So basically, the Canaanites, like, defeat themselves. They, like, destroy their own army. Like, they're drowned, and they're trampling each other, whatever, and the Jews receive victory. So, like any good teacher, Deborah doesn't let them just, like, kind of slide by this moment. She says, no, let me just remind you of a few things. Now that we've received this victory, we're victors, we're, like, we're about to have peace in the land of Israel for, she didn't know that yet, but for about 20 years. Let me remind you how we got here. Basically, you haven't been holding up your end of the... One more minute? Okay. Yeah. Almost done. So you haven't been holding up your end of the bargain. You haven't been doing what we had agreed to do with God when we were with Moses over on Mount Sinai. And if you uphold your end of the bargain, and you do what you're supposed to do, and you don't fall to the ways of idols, then Hashem's going to keep his end of the bargain, and he's going to have peace in Israel. So the name Zipporah, it means bee. And a bee can either sting or it can be sweet. It can give honey, you know? So I feel like what we can learn from Deborah's women is that she knew the time when to sting, when to be sharp with the people, and she knew the time when to be sweet, like we see with her husband, and to be careful and to guide them gently. So that's something I feel like we as women can take away from her life story. Thank you.
So I am talking about Abigail. Actually, we find Abigail in a very incompatible marriage. She is found in the first book of Shmuel, Shmuel Aleph, right after Shmuel Hanavi, Samuel the prophet, dies. We find her married to a man named Naval. And the text in the story tells us that she was good and intelligent, and he was someone who was evil. And when we talk about how Abigail was good and intelligent and she was beautiful, it was really, she was toho kibaro, meaning that her inner beauty radiated outward and allowed her, she was known to be one of the four women in the Tanakh who was physically beautiful. And it was really because of her internal beauty, her intelligence, her goodwill, her grace, her courage. And we'll see a little bit more as the story progresses. Her husband, on the other hand, was named Naval, and like his name, he was evil, he was selfish. According to different commentaries, the text says that he was Bli'al, according to different commentaries, that's kind of a threefold criticism of him, that he was negligent legally, morally, and spiritually. So he was negligent legally because he committed adultery. He was negligent legally because he failed to give tzedakah. He was negligent morally because he committed adultery, and he was negligent spiritually because he worshipped idols. And so it seems to be on the surface a very incompatible marriage. The story goes that Neville he was very, very wealthy, and he came from the tribe of Yehuda, and he had a lot of shepherds that would go and kind of roam the hills in the Carmel area. And at this time, before David had been officially proclaimed king, he was proclaimed king by Hashem privately, but this was while Shaul was still king. David was running away from Shaul, and his men, David's soldiers, helped protect and take care of Naval's shepherds while they were shepherding in the fields. And the time came for the sheep to be sheared, and it was, according to the Torah, it's like a very common, or according to the Tanakh, it's a very, very festive occasion where it's considered it's a great time to share your wealth with others, and the sheep shearing ceremony is a big deal, and people come from all over to take part in the celebration. And what happened was that David went to Naval. He sent messengers to Naval to say, "Hey, Naval, remember us from a while back? We took care of your sheep. Can you now spare some of your meat and some of your food to share with us, because we're on the run and we don't have anything to eat because we're running away from Shaul?" And Neville responds very negatively, and he actually, not only does he say no, but he kind of insults David at the core, saying, "Who is this guy, this Ben Yishai guy? Who is he? Where does he come from? This is not okay. We're not giving him anything." And David feels like he has to kind of take the initiative here and show Naval that what he did was wrong. And so he issues a death threat to Naval. And he says, like, "Let's gather up our army. We're going to go to Naval and we're going to attack Naval." And on their way, meanwhile, they're on their way, and one of the servants of Naval had overheard this conversation between David's messengers and Naval, and had heard his master tell David's messengers that we're not going to give him anything. And so this servant ran to Abigail, Naval's wife, and told her what happened. Okay, so that's also very interesting, that he knows he can't talk to Naval about this. He knows that he should really be going to Abigail and trying to talk to her about it. And so he goes to Abigail and he tells her what happened, and she knows quickly that this whole household is going to be destroyed if she doesn't do something. And so she gathers together an excessive amount of food. It tells us 200 loaves of bread, tons and tons and tons of food, and she gathers it together and puts it on the wagons, and she quickly mounts a horse and goes, or actually I think it's a donkey, and she goes and tries to meet David head on to convince him not to destroy her husband and her household. And she meets him and she explains who she is, and first right away she shows him the food so as to calm him down, and she tells him it's really a mistake to try to kill my husband for three reasons, okay? And this is very courageous of her that she's going and telling David this. So she says for three reasons. She said, first of all, Naval is incapable of being hospitable, so you can't really blame him, okay? She says, second of all, I wasn't aware of this request. I didn't know that you were coming to ask for food. Had I known, I would have given you, so the mistake really lies with me. And the third thing she says is, you're not really technically the king yet. Even though Hashem has appointed you the king, don't view this as an issue of being morid b'malchut, meaning don't view this as an issue of rebelling against the king, because you're not technically the king yet, so you don't have to kill Naval, okay? And she basically calms David down, okay? And David agrees with her, and he backs off, and he leaves, okay? Now, the story doesn't end there, because then she goes home. And Naval, it tells us, is in the middle of this huge feast. He is excessively drunk, And she decides to hold off and not tell Naval anything at that moment. The next morning, when he's not as drunk, she goes to him and she explains what happened and how she averted disaster and basically saved his life. And the text tells us at that moment his heart grows very weak. And it's about 10 days later that Naval dies. And after he dies, Abigail marries David. Okay, David sends messengers and Abigail marries him. So first, right off the bat, what do we learn from this? We learn don't listen to your husbands, right? So, no, of course, that's not the message. But what I see from this story is it's a very difficult story. It's a very difficult lesson. But what I see from this is the opportunity to take the moral high ground. She's in this incompatible relationship. The text doesn't tell us why she's in this relationship with Naval from the beginning. But we see from this that whether it's a difficult marriage, whether it's a difficult relationship, a personal relationship, maybe it's a difficult professional relationship we have with someone at work. Whatever the relationship is, we always have the opportunity to take the moral high ground. And it's something that, as women, we have this ability that we've kind of inherited from Abigail, that we can be dedicated to doing the right thing even when it's so much easier not to do the right thing. It's so much easier to get angry. It's so much easier not to overlook the negativity that someone has brought upon us, right? But it's so important, right, to take that moral high ground, because anything less than taking the moral high ground is just a bankrupt approach, right? It's just going to create disaster within ourselves and possibly spread to others. And so I think that that's the lesson that we really learned from Abigail, is that she knew how to take the moral high ground. She knew how to turn what could have been a singular reality, what David was looking at as a very singular reality. She could have just taken it and continued on with it and marry David after Naval got wiped out, but she knew that there was something greater, and she knew that there was a greater way for her to act and for David to act. And so she really helped save not only Naval's life at that moment, but she also helped save David's life at that moment. So that's all.
There you go.
Okay. I'm going to be quoting the text a little bit, so if this helps you.
How can I do this one?
Okay. The beginning is in Hebrew, and then there's the English also that follows.
Thank you.
Okay, the story of Hannah starts with a mention of her husband, whose name was Elkanah, and he actually had two wives. One was Hannah and one was Peninnah. And the text says Peninnah had children and Hannah did not have children. And each year, Elkanah would go with his two wives, Hannah and Peninnah, to Shiloh, where the Mishkan was. Three times a year, the Jews would go to serve Hashem, Sukkot, Pesach, and Shavuos. And Elkanah was part of this group that went up with his two wives and along with Peninnah's children, his kids. And they would bring a carbon to Hashem there, and the carbon, the sacrifice that was brought, was one that the people who brought the sacrifice went away with some of the meat and they would eat it. So he would give out portions to his wives and his children of the sacrifice that was brought. And he would give some to Peninnah, and he would give some to each of Peninnah's children. And to Hannah, he would give more. And it says he gave more because he loved her. And if you look at the three bold words, it says, Vashem sagar achma. Hashem had closed her womb. It's basically telling us she didn't have kids, and she also did not have the ability naturally in the state she was in at that time to have children because Hashem had closed her womb. And if we think about the other people in Tanakh who are mentioned who don't have children, the other women, of course what comes to mind is Sarah, Rivka, and Rachel. And if you look on the third page on the bottom, I have the text that I'm going to mention. If we look at the wording there, it says, "V'Sarai eshes Avram lo yaldalo." Sarai, the wife of Avram, had not born him any children. And for Rivka it says ki akarahi, because she was barren, and for Rachel akara, and Rachel was barren. So it mentions they didn't have children for some time, but it doesn't say anything about their physical state that didn't allow them to have children. It just seems like they didn't give birth yet. But with Hannah it sounds like Hashem, like almost in more human terms, Hashem had actually done an action to close her womb so that she didn't have the ability to have children, which we can a little bit take away from this, that in order for her to have children may have been like more of a miracle, if there's such a thing, than for Sarah, Rivka, and Rachel to have children. But anyway, we'll talk about that more in a minute. Anyway, she was very upset that she didn't have children. She would cry. She wouldn't be able to eat. And she took the opportunity to dive into Hashem, right? She said, if I have a problem, then who do I turn to? I turn to God, right? So she does. She sends out this heart-wrenching prayer, tears and tears, and she just really, really pours her heart out to God, asking him for children. And it comes partially from just a woman's need and a woman's desire to reproduce and have kids, and it also comes from her strong desire to serve Hashem. Like, she wants to serve God in every way possible, and as an individual she was doing that, but she felt that she could do more if she had a child. And what's interesting is that Hashem gives us whatever we need in this world. If my mission in life is, you know, something that I need money and intelligence for, I'm going to have the money and intelligence for it. If it's something I need health and children for, I'm going to have the health and children for it. But Hashem had decided what Hannah was supposed to accomplish in this world, and she didn't need kids for that. Whatever she was responsible to take care of in this physical world, she didn't need kids for that. She had the tools she needed. And Hashem sagar rahma, Hashem closed her womb. It just wasn't necessary. And that's not to say Hashem's not going to give us more than the tools we need to accomplish our goal here. But I think it takes a little extra to get more than just the basic tools we need. And one of the ways to do that is through tefillah, through prayer. It says, the second set of bold words, it says, it's talking about the way she prayed. She was really, really speaking from the heart. She was moving her lips, but her words were not heard. And this, what's interesting here is that later on, when the tefillah, the prayers were written down and rules were come up with of how people are supposed to pray, they were taken from Hannah. And the interesting thing is that the guidelines for prayer are really more specific with men than they are with women. Things like, you know, how often to pray and what words should be said and davening in a group. And women don't have as much responsibility in that way. We have to pray, but not with the same specific guidelines. But the interesting thing is that the guidelines came from a woman. And I think what it's telling us here is that perhaps the fewer guidelines for a woman are because the women don't need the guidelines. You know, like if you think of I deal with high school girls a lot. So if I think of the girls who receive the material from the teacher and they study and they do well on a test without the guidelines, they're able to take the material and they know how to study and review it, and then they're able to do well on the test. And then there are some girls who, you know, they don't know how to make a chart, they don't know what's important, they don't know what to study first. They really, really, really need guidelines. And their guidelines are helping them to come out with a good product. And they need the guidelines more. But I think that with women and prayer, I think that we, because of the way we're made, I think that we have the power to create a prayer and daven and really pour our hearts out without the specific guidelines of has to be this many times a day, it has to be these specific words, it has to be this long, it has to be this time of day. I think that it's telling us that women have something extra, and that we can produce a prayer that really soars without these guidelines. And ultimately, Hannah does have a child, which is a result of this prayer. And then she davens again. She says a shira to Hashem. She says a song to Hashem, thanking him and praising him for giving her a child, and later six more, seven total. And if you look at the third set of bold words, it says, Arakara yalda shiba rabas badim umlala. It talks about the prayer in general is almost like Eric Carle's Book of Opposites. The Hashem, you know, if you're rich, you can become poor. If you're poor, become rich. If you're strong, you become weak. If you're weak, you can become strong. Hashem can do anything. Hashem can take anything in this world and turn it completely upside down, totally inside out. And that's a message for us. You know, what we're given in a life is not set in stone. If we have prayer, we can soar. We can go above and beyond what's ordained for us. And that's exactly what happened to Hannah. She had no children, and then she had children, and Penina, unfortunately, had children, and she lost her children. So I think the take-home message is that as women, we have an incredible power of tefillah, and we really should use it for us, because sometimes God has something for us and just waiting for us to ask.
Hi, I'm speaking about Miriam the prophetess, and actually yesterday in the parasha on Shabbat, that's the first time she's mentioned in Parashat Shemot. So actually, Yonit, I sent you an email telling you that I don't think it's necessary to speak about Miriam because all the women were in synagogue yesterday. And, you know, they know all about it, so there's no point.
Now go to questions and answers.
Okay, yeah, go on. Anyway, so Miriam was born in Egypt to Yocheved and Amram. Yocheved was the daughter of Levi, who's the son of Yaakov, and Amram was the grandson of Levi. So it's aunt and nephew. They got married and they had Miriam, Moshe, and Aharon. So Miriam was the sister of Moshe and Aharon. She was born in Egypt and she died at 123 before they entered the lands of Israel. Now the first time Miriam is mentioned in this parasha, she's not called Miriam, she's called Puah. Paro spoke to the midwives, one who was called Shifra and one Puah, and he told them, please make sure that the Jewish boys, that you kill the Jewish boys when they're born, but the Jewish girls you can keep alive. So Miriam was called Puah. Puah means crying, and she would like calm the babies down and rock them when they were born. And another meaning for Puah, it comes from Hofia, which means to stand up against. And Miriam stood up against Paro. Paro was the king. And she didn't care what he said. She said, I'm refusing. I'm not going to harm these babies. She didn't listen. She was little. I think she was 3 years old, like my oldest daughter. And there she was, standing up against Paro, and she refused to listen to him. Now, Miriam's father, Amram, he was the head of the Sanhedrin, of the Jewish court. And he saw that Paro was just throwing all the baby boys into the Nile. He said, what's the point of having more children? So he goes and separates from his wife. And because he was the head of the leader, so all the men did the same. The men in that generation, they all separated from their wives. And little Miriam comes up to her father and she says, Daddy, do you know what you're doing? You are son Paro. Paro was here, he wants to kill the Jewish boys. You're killing the Jewish boys and the Jewish girls. Paro wants death in this world, but you're decreeing death in this world and the next, by not bringing any children into the world. And who says Paro's decree will come to fruition? So Amram thought what his little daughter was telling him, and he agreed. He saw that he was making a big mistake, and he reunited with his wife, and so did all the men in that generation. And everyone continued having children. And guess who was born after Amram reunited with his wife? Moshe, the leader of Israel. Thanks to Miriam, thanks to her, you know, Moshe redeemed the Jewish people. Now, so Miriam prophesied that she's, my mother will have a son who would redeem Israel. So when her parents saw that the Egyptians are coming close and they're going to take away their son, so they said, let's put him in a basket, we'll stick him in the Nile. And, you know, and they were like, oh, Miriam, you told us that Moshe is going to be the redeemer. Look now, look what's happening. But Miriam just ignored what they were saying, and she said, listen, no, she thought to herself, Hashem told me this, that he's going to be the redeemer of Israel. I stand up to what I believe, and it's going to happen no matter what. So she goes, the mother goes and sticks him into the basket, and Miriam stands there watching. She stood there, like she stood, she knew that it was going to happen. It's not like she was like, oh, it's not going to happen. She had total faith. She knew he was going to be saved. And she helped when Batya came, the daughter of Paro, and she took him out. So Miriam helped and she told him, look, you can find a wet nurse for her, a Jewish one. And you know, she was helping. And she made sure that Moshe would grow up in the palace. And like that, he would like learn the techniques of how to be a leader, you know, from Paro, because he was the king. Now, Miriam, the whole time she would encourage the women to continue Jewish survival. They were in such terrible conditions. The men would worked so hard. The slavery was just terrible. And the Miriam told the women, listen, we're going to be redeemed. Don't worry, there's hope. She put so much trust and faith in the women. And like some people used to laugh at her. They were like, you know, there's no hope for us. The children are being thrown into the Nile. You know, well, we're not going to come out of this. And thanks to Miriam, she put so much faith into the women. And we learned that I'll say that later. So when they left Mitzrayim, they had no time to take anything with them. They were like, it was a whole big rush, and still the women took the tambourines because they were sure. Miriam put so much faith and hope in them. They were so sure that they were going to leave and they're going to be redeemed, even though everything just seemed like so dark and terrible. So they took the tambourines with them, and then by the splitting of the sea, the women went, and Miriam sang with them songs, and they played the tambourines. Now, in the desert, there was a well of water, and that was in the merit of Miriam. How do we see that? Because when she died, the well disappeared. So the whole 40 years in the desert, they had a well of water that everyone drank from and used and washed themselves, and all thanks to Miriam. And Miriam, she happened to speak Lashon Hara about her brother Moshe. Now, what did she already say? She was speaking to her brother Haron about the Cushite woman that he married. And Moshe married Tzipporah. They were speaking about it, because Miriam had spoken to Tzipporah earlier, and Tzipporah told her that she's separating, she's not having relations anymore with her husband, because he has to be ready for conversation with Hashem the whole time. So Hashem said that he shouldn't have relations with his wife. So Miriam was discussing it, and she said, listen, we're also prophets. Hashem didn't tell us this. Maybe Moshe is making a mistake. Now, for that, Miriam was punished, and she had to leave the camp for 7 days. But she was so dear to Hashem, and Hashem saw that she cared so much. She cared so much for Moshe. She cared so much for the continuity of the Jewish survival. And that's why she was like, you know, imagine every prophet just separates from his wife because they want to be ready to speak to Hashem. She said, like, what's going to happen with the continuity of the Jewish nation? So she did this all because she cared so much for her brother, and she wanted him, you know, to continue building the Jewish nation and for all the other prophets. But then Hashem came and Hashem spoke to her, and he said, listen, Miriam, your brother Moshe is different than any prophet. To him I speak mouth to mouth. So this is what I told him, and he's different. So Miriam understood. But we see that the fact that the Jews had to wait, they wanted to go to a different place, to camp in a different place, but they waited for 7 days for Miriam to come back, because she had to leave the camp and she had leprosy. So they waited for her 7 days to come back. It just shows how special she was, and how Hashem saw that she cared so much for the Jewish nation. You know, she didn't do it out of speaking bad, but because she was so special and so high, like such a different level than us, so for Hashem it was considered Lashon Hara. So I'm finishing off. Miriam, she cared so much for the survival of the Jewish nation, and thanks to her, the Jewish nation continued, and the leader of the Jewish people was born. And thank you very much.
So we have a few minutes for questions, if anyone would like to send a question. Happens to be a no one? Go.
Maybe I didn't understand the beginning, but can you tell me a little more about how each of these women processes specifically? Because I feel like you talk about like, their story and their contributions, but sometimes Russian, you talk a little bit about Miriam,
So it's interesting when a person has, so there's the Rambam basically gives us outlines according, and it's considered like the basic approach in the Moreh Nevuchim about how a person develops level of prophecy. They have to be morally and spiritually and intellectually on a high enough level. But it's interesting because there are many, many people who have a level of prophecy. But according to kind of the rules in Judaism, once a person has any level of prophecy, they're automatically considered a prophet. And so each of the women had a certain level of prophecy. For example, Abigail had a moment of prophecy when she was relaying the message to David and trying to calm him down and placate him so he wouldn't kill Nabal. She basically had a level of prophecy that she saw that, number one, that Nabal was going to die anyway in a few days, and number two, that David was going to make a mistake with Bathsheba and kind of create a situation whereby he could marry Bathsheba and kill off her husband. And so she had that level of prophecy at that moment, but since then she was considered a prophet. Now why she was chosen over other women, for example, Rachel and Leah also had prophecies. There's a whole other discussion as to why she is considered one of the seven prophets, one of the seven female prophets, and not, for example, Rachel and Leah or other women that had it. But essentially, any time a woman has a prophecy, she's declared a prophet, even if it's just a temporary prophecy at that moment. So
you said there's seven total.
There's seven total, yes. So there's Sarah, Hannah, not Rivka, Sarah, Hannah, Miriam, Esther, Deborah, Abigail,
Huldah,
and Huldah. Huldah's the last that we don't really talk about so much. But she was a prophet who lived during the time of Yoshiyahu, and she prophesied during the destruction of the temple, the first temple. And so she, I think it's the first temple, and she prophesied, and her words of prophecy were more as a form of comforting. So those were...
So I just want to mention something, like how we can apply this to nowadays. It says that the women in Egypt, when their husbands came back from slaving away, so the husbands were exhausted, and thanks to Miriam that she encouraged the women so much and put so much hope in them, so they would come and bring their husbands food and drink and, you know, revive them. And they would have these copper mirrors and they would look at themselves and decorate themselves for their husbands, and then their husbands desired them and had relations with them, and that's how they brought more children to the world. That's how they continued the Jewish nation. So I just feel like, you know, that was in the such terrible conditions. There was slavery and everything was just so bad, and the women dressed themselves up and decorated themselves for their husbands, and here we are in America, the land of plenty, we have everything, you know. Well, one thing, it's so hard for us even to have one child, you know, and forget in such great conditions. And also, when we have the children, where do we send them to? Like, we send them to public schools. We're not enabling the Jewish nation to continue. You know, the children then marry out and terrible things happen. And also in the, you know, these women, like how much do we, when our husbands come back home, do we look good for them, like these women did in Egypt? Or do we look like rags, and just when we have to go out to shopping or to meet to have coffee with our friends, then we all put on our makeup and look so good. And we have to just think about it, myself included, to look good for our husbands and not only for other people. That's the most important, to have a good relationship with our husbands and to continue building the Jewish nation.
Do we have room for one more question, you think, or wrap it up? Well, thank you so much to our panel speakers. They're available throughout the day if anyone wants to come. Thank you so much. if you go, do you want those? Yeah, maybe return. Do you want those?
You can keep them. I took the Seamus out, so they can whatever. But if you want, I'll take them. I don't care. Doesn't matter to me. Yeah, you can just throw them if you want.
Nice, everyone. Great job.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Maya.
Thank you. Well done. Well done.
Thank nice to see you. I met you in LA.
Yeah, right. Right.
So nice. All these mothers came.
Pardon?
You're from Palo Alto?
No, no, I'm from LA. I'm obviously
from LA.
Mother,
oh.
And I have to come to
the what?
I'm just
really.
I'm going to, like, at a certain point, I'm going to realize that you're.
Shane's
you.
Shane's
you. Yeah, yeah. What's funny thing is my daughter named Nina. So people call me Panita all the time. People don't know my son. Yeah, I'm calling Panita Nina. And people call me Panita because they get mixed up with my daughter or whatever. And I'm always like, yeah, but I've been dealing with my whole life because.
The second you started talking about, wow. If I started tweeting on the phone,
did you get the? I made this for trifle recipe. Said she got it from her sister.
Someone said strawberry and berries.
No, but that sounds good.
She said she got it from
like a crunch on top or something. Yeah, I've seen my mother have it or my sister, but I never did it.
Everybody knew I had it.
Oh, yeah, I never had it.
Okay, your older sister makes it.
You're supposed to really enjoy it. You teach, right?
I just make a show.
What do you teach?
I teach middle school.
Category, and Spila is separate. But otherwise, they each only have 2 minutes, 45 minutes. So he does 2 1/3, and 2 1/3, all night.
Is this his first time teaching?
He's taught very part time in Europe for 2 years, just one period.
Well, it might be my father.
He does mission. He does 8th grade for mission.
I don't know if he learned to bounce. We'll see if she was able to
bounce. Yeah,
oh, very smart. But it's a cousin.
Yeah, I know that.
So my husband grew up in San
Diego.
So this is really different for you, huh?
Yeah, definitely.
Just getting these things, you know. No, not me.
Yeah, it's the change, you know.
Oh, very much so.
Yeah, I'd have to get used to that first, and then think, oh,
this is
good. From Gibraltar, from Gibraltar, forget it. Like, Israel is the land of plenty. Gibraltar.
And you can't sell out. Because they forgot the advertisement. I've got to remember, but, like, I was waiting for, like, the memo, you know, that it kind of got put together while I was gone.
No,
you
just can't believe it.
Then my mother-in-law invited me to this other room.
Right, the religious population in Gibraltar, I guess, is 700
I RSVP'd for a donation as a sponsor person.
Yeah.
And what if I'm having a question?
Yeah,
I'm going
to go for
a scuba. I'm going to go for a scuba. Oh, wow. It's
really
amazing. Everything's like at the same time. Like, what was I thinking?
Yeah,
yeah,
that's
the math. Yeah,
that's
amazing.
Amazing.
Our name will be on the program, so she'll be
so
like,
really
proud. Yeah,
yeah,
this is great.
What's your name?
I mean,
I guess I can tell you
did
my last name.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Enfield. Enfield.
I know.
Did
I know more? But I think you very little better.
Do you want me to give you my ID as well?
I'm like,
I didn't know last name was the last one.
I think that's just
that was you.
I think that was yours.
Yeah. Maybe he thought like I was, you know, trying to know all about his life.
No,
it's
not.
So where are you from?
From Los Angeles.
And
West
you live
Hollywood.
Here?
I live here in San Jose.
No, like San Jose. Very nice. I'm in Barrio Cano. Barrio Cano is San Diego.
Oh,
my husband's right.
Okay, is Barrio Cano.
Svaldi Shoe.
Okay.
I keep thinking that people know what it is. But they don't know. No, my husband says everyone, no, I'm from Barrio Cano. And I'm like, tell me where that is.
Is that in Israel?
Yeah, that was so
how's that working out?
Yeah, great. Like, we have yeah. 5 months.
And then he's like, is
that
you know,
true? Can you make that
I only have
yeah. Oh, so you got a lot of growing to do, I guess.
Yeah.
That's great. That's
no,
great.
People think, you know, when I just stepped in here, people were like, oh, give classes, do this. And I'm like, chill out. And then I get, you know, I just got my Shabbat dishes like a few days ago. Because like I didn't, we couldn't bring everything from Israel. We just get things a break, we gave many things away. You know, it takes time to get furniture and everything. Just to be settled in.
Yeah, because I don't even see the... Like,
how long are you here for?
The guy probably is going to set up faster.
Long time.
And then 10 years.
10 years. Okay, that's long.
Yeah, it feels like forever because I have 2 kids. And, you know,
nice.
It feels like a very long time. So are you newlywed? Yeah,
I'm 4 years.
Oh,
I have 3 kids.
Oh, you have 3 kids.
Twins.
So where do they go to school?
So one goes to the school. Yeah, she's 3, and then the twins are 2. No, sorry.
Oh.
I stay here at SPHDS.
Okay.
Like there.
Yeah, so, okay, yeah.
For me, my house is like, you just
well,
point
from the... I'm actually a preschool music teacher.
Really?
That's what I do. And I teach.
Very nice.
That's why I'm like, is there a preschool here? Because this is a JCC building. I don't come here except for this event. But I teach local to San Jose. So I teach 10 classes at the JCC preschool. And I teach 4 classes at Shir Hadash preschool.
Wow.
And I teach 3 classes at Sinai preschool.
Wow. So I didn't know there were so many preschools. Oh, wow.
Yeah, well, those are not observant, you know.
Right.
But since I have the background, I do a Jewish music, mostly Jewish music curriculum.
Nice.
So I keep them in sync with the holidays and stuff. So I am very much.
Wow, I'm sure they could use you. I mean, you're probably full.
And I'm also a music together teacher. So I have a... I'm trained in childhood music development. So I play the guitar. So the kids.
Why? Are you very busy or you have like.
I could. I have one morning that I could be open for one more Jewish place. I want to be a Jewish place so that I don't
so
do the holidays.
Maybe the school heads, do they know about you?
I don't know if they know about me.
Because I think they have some music, but why not get a Jewish person?
Yeah.
You know, if
they
you
should have
pick
a Jewish person.
And I don't know if they have anyone
the
Jewish. I don't know because I just came, but I can find out.
Find out for me. Or find out for them. Like, drop
give
my
me
name.
A number.
Because the kids with me, I don't just play the guitar. I have music and movement and percussion. So they get 2 instrument opportunities of, you know, beats. We have at least 1 dance that we do in the session, in addition to the sit and sing and the lullaby. So
wow.
And I keep it tied with the Jewish holidays, so it's always varied with the season.
Oh, wow. That's so nice. Okay.
I would love... I mean,
I have to find out, because you know, I don't know anything what they have in the school.
And the thing is, my daughter is currently in public school, but I want her to go to South Peninsula for middle school. So I could use a little extra to make that happen. So why not? If I'm lucky enough to get her in,
right.
And then we drive out there, it'd be a great place. I'm already there.
it's a great place.
Okay.
It really.
So I'm gonna tell me.
I'll call you up, and then
okay.
You have my number.
Okay, you've got 408.
Yeah.
887.
Yeah.
3415.
Okay.
And then I'll get that phone, and then I'll
put and I'm going to write Music Lady.
Oh, you write like Karen.
Because if
Enzi.
I write
yeah.
a Music Lady,
oh.
and then I write
yeah.
Karen. Music?
Yeah. Lady.
Karen. Okay.
Karen.
Music
yeah.
Karen.
Enfield. Enfield.
Okay. Great. Okay, like that. And now I'll call you. And you can call,
mm-hmm.
I don't know what you want to call me. Sunnyvale.
Oh,
well, you're going to remember Rachelie Maimon?
Mm-hmm.
Really? You're going to look for me. You're going to go through
and
all your
you
contacts.
Are, I don't well,
you know, sometimes
well,
I write the
so
person's
perfect.
Name and then.
But I'll put on, I have a note. So, Rach. I just make it Rachelie.
Yeah.
I like how you spell
oh,
it. That's cute.
Maimonides?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, oh, you called me, but just tell me your phone number anyways.
650-307-0095.
And then I will write out a field of notes. And I will write that you are Bar Yochai. Bar Yochai. Whoops. Hi, Robertson.
Great.
And then if I go, oh, Bar Yochai, I would search on Bar Yochai.
Right, I guess, you know, you've got a normal cell phone. Normal camera. Mine is considered...
Someone put this on. Did they take this? Is it still recording?
It's still on, right?